to create a teenage culture that Americans viewed with deep anxiety. Fears of juvenile delinquency were bi-coastal, inspiring Hollywood films such as Rebel Without a Cause, and, as we'll hear at length in the next chapter, Blackboard Jungle, and galvanizing Washington subcommittees on the terrible problem of teens. These forces conspired to unleash an abundance of leisure time, a temporal vacuum that teenagers filled with experimentation. The abolition of child labor and the lengthening span of formal education have given us a huge leisure class of the young, with animal energies never absorbed by tasks of production, wrote one New York Times critic in 1957. Even in the early years of their classification, teenagers were regarded as cultural nomads. Rather than settle into the established rituals of American society, they were roving vagabonds seeking out new frontiers of tastes and behavior. In 1953, J. Edgar Hoover published an FBI report warning that the nation can expect an appalling increase in the number of crimes that will be committed by teenagers in the years ahead. The message reverberated in Congress, where President Dwight Eisenhower used his 1955 State of the Union to call for a federal legislation to assist the states in dealing with this nationwide problem. Frederick Wortham's international bestseller, Seduction of the Innocent, relied on sketchy forensics and hysterical prissiness to argue that comics were a cause of juvenile delinquency. He called comic books short courses in murder, mayhem, robbery, rape, cannibalism, carnage, necrophilia, sex, sadism, masochism, and virtually every other form of crime, degeneracy, bestiality, and horror. As soon as teenagers were invented, they were feared. Many social critics made no distinction between the young carjacking thieves and the comic readers. To an old worrywart, they were all feral gypsy sprites. The last 60 years have made teenagers separate. But are they really so different? Or are teens just like adults, but with less money, fewer responsibilities, and no mortgage? There is some evidence that, as many parents quietly suspect, teenagers are chemically distinct from the rest of humanity. They suffer uniquely from loosely connected frontal lobes, the decision center of the brain, and an enlarged nucleus accumbens, the pleasure center. So where adults tend to see the downsides of risky behavior in high definition, teenagers see the potential rewards as if projected onto an IMAX screen with surround sound. The result is sadly predictable. Teens take more risks and suffer more accidents. Americans between 15 and 19 have a mortality rate that's about 3 times higher than those ages 5 to 14. For Lawrence Steinberg, a career investigating the teenage mind started with a common observation that is self-evident to parents, teachers, or anybody with even the faintest memories of high school. Teenagers often act dumber around other teenagers. Steinberg, a psychologist at Temple University, put people of various ages in a simulated driving game with streets and stoplights. Adults drove the same, whether or not they had an audience. But teenagers took twice as many chances, like running a yellow light when their friends were watching. Teenagers are exquisitely sensitive to the influence of their peers. The precise definition of coolness may change over time, from cigarettes to snaps, but the deep animal need to possess it does not. But what is coolness, anyway? In sociology, it is sometimes defined as a positive rebellion. It means breaking away from an illegitimate mainstream in a legitimate way. That might sound like a fussy definition, but it has its uses. My high school had a dress code, and when you're 14 years old, violating a repressive clothing regime is a beautifully obvious way to signal to other kids that you're non-compliant. But not always. What about sagging your slacks at a school memorial for war heroes? Or proudly untucking your shirt at a funeral for the school's favorite teacher? The same group of people can consider an outfit cool or deeply disrespectful, depending on how legitimate people view the norm that it's violating. For Maya's sake, cool means most autonomous, yet appropriate. At the end of the 20th century, many teens gravitated to logos. The long economic expansion from the 1980s and the 1990s gave them the means to spend lavishly on clothing emblems. A fashion hit like Ralph Lauren was based not only on the quality of the garment, but also on the logo's talismanic power in high school hallways. At the same time, the most popular TV shows on network and cable often featured beautiful California teenagers with sand-tousled hair, like The O.C. and Laguna Beach. Los Angeles culture beamed across the country and elevated surf and skate brands like Hurley, Billabong, and Vans. Several decades of logo fever came to an abrupt end in the Great Recession. Nearly half of families experienced a job loss, a pay cut, or reduced hours, and youth unemployment soared to almost 19%. The richly embroidered logos on Ralph Lauren polo shirts were suddenly unwelcome in a financial downturn, and cheaper, fast fashion retailers like H&M, Zara, and Uniqlo grew. In a new age of cool, the smartphone screen displaced the embroidered logo as the focal point of teen identity. It was once sufficient to look good in a high school hallway, but today Snapchat, Facebook, and Instagram are all high school hallways, where young people perform and see performances, judge and are judged. Many decades after another mobile device, the car, helped to invent the teenager, the iPhone and its ilk offered new, nimble instruments of self-expression, symbols of independence, and better ways to hook up. And so, in half a century, teenagers went from being a newfangled classification of awkward youth to an existential threat to American security to a valuable consumer demographic and worthy topic of research. Teenagers are the market's neophiles, the group most likely to accept a new musical sound, a new clothing fashion, or a new technology trend. For adults, especially those with power and money, the rules are what keep you safe. When you're young, every rule is illegitimate until proven otherwise. It is precisely because they have so little to lose from the way things are that young people will continue to be the inexhaustibly neophilic motor of culture. In the first chapters of this book, I explored how sneaky familiarity creates the aha moments that people crave from art, music, stories, and products. I tried to understand hits and popularity by thinking about individuals. But that's only half the story. One of the lessons of teenage culture is that people don't decide what they like all by themselves. They determine coolness based on their perception of what is mainstream and what is not, what is radical and what is appropriate, what their community is doing versus what other cliques consider cool. In this way, we are all teenagers. Consumers are constantly learning, changing, and responding to the decisions of the people around them. This makes popularity a complex system. A person can perfectly understand the formation of rain and still not be able to predict the next thunderstorm. Weather is often described as a chaotic system that makes it challenging to forecast temperature and precipitation too far in advance. The markets for cultural goods, movies, games, art, and apps can be the same. Any investigation of the market for hits has to begin with an appreciation of this uncertainty. Culture is chaos. Part 2. Popularity and the Market. Chapter 7. Rock and Roll and Randomness. Crickets, Chaos, and the Biggest Hit in Rock and Roll History. We're gonna rock around the clock. The 1954 record by Bill Haley and his Comets was the first rock and roll song to reach number one on the Billboard charts. With more than 40 million copies sold, it is, by some counts, the second best-selling song of all time, after Bing Crosby's White Christmas. 60 years after its release, the hook seems congenitally catchy, and if you can listen for 15 seconds without bouncing your head or tapping your foot, you deserve some sort of Michelin prize for self-control. But the full history of Rock Around the Clock suggests that the song is best thought of not as an obvious world-conquering hit, but as the world's biggest fluke. Its luck nearly strains credulity and suggests that even the biggest hits often need the light touch of fortune's tailwind. William Haley Jr. grew up in a poor musical family. His father, William Sr., was a mechanic who played the banjo, and his mother, Maud, gave piano lessons in their home. Blind in his left eye since childhood, William Jr. was shy, and even his most flamboyant attribute from his adult years, the prominent kiss curl in his hair, was reportedly done to divert attention away from his eye. When Haley was 13, his father bought him a used guitar for Christmas, and a love affair began. Despite his poor sight, Haley mastered the instrument and spent his teenage years yodeling in several country bands. Haley's dream, to tour the country singing hillbilly ballads of cowboys, appeared hopeless from the get-go. He moved home in his 20s, dead broke, and settled into a new career as the musical director for a radio station in Pennsylvania. Not quite done writing music, however, Haley used his position to meet new artists and soak up ideas for songs. He started several bands, including a Western swing group called the Saddlemen. Haley loved country Western music, and he gradually learned to blend the influences of his childhood, the hillbilly twang, the cowboy country swagger, and the new race music, so called because it was mostly played by black bands like the Orioles, who pushed the boundaries of rhythm and blues. When a radio music director heard Bill Haley and the Saddlemen, he suggested a cooler name for the band. With a Haley leading the group, he suggested, why not something related to the celestial rock of the same name? The band changed their name to Bill Haley and His Comets. Their first hit came in 1952 with Crazy Man Crazy, a largely forgotten and simple-as-pie tune that has the distinction of being the first rock and roll song to chart on Billboard. But Haley was eager to push the tempo. In 1953, he brought the song Rock Around the Clock to his label, Essex Records. Dave Miller, the label's founder, wouldn't let him record it. In fact, Miller was so confident it was a dud that on numerous occasions he ripped up the music in front of Haley to seal his case. Haley took the song to a rival label, Decca Records, which agreed to record Rock Around the Clock under one condition. The Comets would have to record another song first, 13 Women and Only One Man in Town, a regrettable song about a man who becomes the custodian of a harem of women after a hydrogen bomb destroys the world. Haley agreed to do it. A studio recording date was set for April 12, 1954, in a converted Masonic temple on 70th Street in New York City. The session was scheduled to begin at 11 a.m. sharp. At 11:30, the comets were nowhere to be seen. In fact, they weren't even in the state of New York. Several hundred miles north, Halley and his band were on the Chester Bridgeport ferry, which had breached a sandbar in the Delaware River. After a tugboat nudged the ferry out of the muck, Halley drove like a demon down to New York City and arrived at the temple 2 hours late, just after 1 p.m. "The next time we have a recording date," one producer suggested, "take the bridge." The band unpacked their instruments and set up on the stage. After more than an hour of rehearsal, they played 3 takes of 13 Women. The producers weren't satisfied. They played the song 3 more times. The studio session was scheduled to end at 5, and by 4:20 they still hadn't played a second of Rock Around the Clock. The first take was loud and energetic, a blissful eruption of controlled chaos. The song was so brief that a guitar solo was required to make it at least 2 minutes long. The guitarist, Danny Cedrone, didn't have time to devise and master a new riff. So for the first take, he copied, literally note for note, a 15-second solo he had played on Bill Haley's 1952 song, Rock the Joint. When the first take ended, the producers played it back. It was a mess. The Comet's instruments were ear-splitting, pushing the needle deep in the red zone. Haley's voice was almost inaudible. Selling a pop song without a vocalist would be a heavy lift, even for a large music label. But it was almost 5 p.m. The studio session was practically over. There was no time left to fix the microphones. The producers offered a solution. The band could play the song one more time, but they would turn off the mics on the instruments. The record would be all on Haley. He would have one shot to nail the vocals. The second take ended without any obvious errors. After 5 p.m., Haley and his band packed up their instruments. The Comets had no idea if the recording was usable. But producers synchronized the 2 tapes, and the final record was ready to be shipped within a month. It must have felt like a small miracle to Haley. After years of begging labels, his perseverance was rewarded, and the song was finally put to wax. But any relief was short-lived. Rock Around the Clock appeared on the B-side to 13 Women, and it was forgotten almost as quickly as it was recorded. Decca mailed thousands of copies of Rock Around the Clock to movie studios and producers around the country and paid for several splashy ads in magazines like Billboard and Variety. In May 1954, Billboard noted the song with a tepid endorsement. "Big beat and repetitious blues lyric make this a good attempt at cat music and one which should grab coin in the right locations." The record did not quite flop. It spent exactly 1 week on the Billboard charts, but it was light years from becoming any sort of hit. In 1953, Crazy Man Crazy had sold 750,000 copies. In 1954, Rock Around the Clock reached exactly 1/10 of that total. Just 75,000 records sold. In a way, we've reached the end of the story. Rock Around the Clock was a mediocre B-side of a middling record. It did not fail for lack of exposure. It received major label and magazine marketing, went to thousands of disc jockeys, played on many radio stations in May 1954, and had appeared on the Billboard charts for 1 week. Then, by July, it was gone. One of so many discs tossed into so many dustbins among the anonymous detritus of pop culture history. Rock Around the Clock had its chance. It failed. Duncan Watts doesn't believe in stories. He prefers chaos. A network theory scientist at Microsoft, Watts trusts computer generations over explanations, and he discounts anecdotes that sound too interesting. He's one of the worst people to talk to if you're trying to write a cohesive book about success in cultural markets as told through interesting examples. So, out of doubt, self-loathing, or some less discernible masochistic instinct, I decided to meet with him for several hours and devote a chapter to his ideas. Tall and square-jawed, with blue eyes behind rectangular frames, Watts is a former Australian Defense Force cadet. He went to Cornell to get his PhD in chaos theory in the mid-1990s, only to discover, to his disappointment, that people were sort of over chaos. He arrived at his program a few years after author James Glick had published his popular book on the subject, Chaos. You know all the low-hanging fruit in a subject has been picked if somebody's writing a mass-market book about it, he told me, twisting a knife. Forced to search outside physics for a satisfyingly chaotic subject in graduate school, Watts became interested in many of the same big questions I'm trying to answer, like why people like what they like, why large groups of people do what they do, and how popularity spreads. Rather than start with designers and songwriters, however, Watts thought about crickets. I got interested first in biology, and I started thinking about networks of crickets and how they synchronize their chirping, he told me. Watts was fascinated by networks of critters, but the larger question he was seeking was about networks of people, like how something can start small, say, a fashion like the name Emma, and grow into a mainstream movement as widespread and synchronized as a field of insects chirping in harmony. Around the same time, Watts was on the phone with his dad, who asked if he'd ever heard of this idea that everyone in the world is connected to the President of the United States by just 6 handshakes. It was 1995, and Watts hadn't heard the theory before. He didn't know if it was obviously true or obviously false. But he started to think that crickets and the 6 degrees of separation were two parts of the same story. He wondered whether social contagions, like cricket sounds, clothing fashions, and pop culture hits, might be governed by the same rules of mass behavior. Perhaps the fundamental question of hits isn't, why do we like what we like, but rather, how does what you like become what I like? One reason I like Watts, even though in our meeting he relished poking holes in some of my theories, is that he is completely unsentimental about why some products succeed, and he's very good at explaining the pitfalls of sentimental explanations. One of his best attacks on woolly-headed thinking is his take on the Mona Lisa as the most popular painting in the world. Today, there is little doubt about the rarefied air of Leonardo da Vinci's portrait. The Mona Lisa is the world's most treasured painting, literally. It holds the Guinness World Record for the most expensive insurance policy on any art piece. In 1973, the art critic Kenneth Clark called the Mona Lisa the supreme example of perfection, saying it deserved its title as the most famous painting in the world. But in the 19th century, it wasn't even the most famous painting in its museum, the Louvre in Paris. The historian Donald Sassoon reported that in 1849, the Mona Lisa was valued at 90,000 francs. That's a tidy sum, but it's not even close to Titian's Supper at Emmaus, 150,000 francs at the time, or Raphael's The Holy Family, 600,000 francs, which hung in the same museum. The Mona Lisa's fame got an assist from a dim-witted thief. On August 11th, 1911, a Monday, Vincenzo Perugia, an unemployed Italian painter, walked into the Louvre and left with the Mona Lisa. French newspapers were aghast at the theft and indignantly proclaimed the painting's historic significance. The Mona Lisa went missing for several years until Perugia, stuck with an expensive artwork whose sale would inevitably lead to his apprehension, tried to hawk the painting in Florence and was duly apprehended. The recovery of the Mona Lisa and its return to France was an international sensation. Several years after the painting's recovery, in 1919, the modernist Marcel Duchamp made a replica of the Mona Lisa with a mustache. He called it L-H-O-O-Q, which, if you pronounce the letters in French, is a homophone for something naughty. Defiling the placid smile of the Mona Lisa struck a lot of other painters as an inexhaustibly funny idea. So, in the last century, some of the most famous painters, including Jasper Johns, Robert Rauschenberg, René Magritte, Salvador Dalí, and Andy Warhol, made their own Mona Lisa parodies. Her face is everywhere now, on coasters, magazine covers, book covers, movie posters, and trinkets. Critics explaining why the Mona Lisa is the most famous painting in history often don't account for the fact that for most of its history, it wasn't. As a result, they end up saying something like, "The Mona Lisa is the most famous painting in the world because it has all of the qualities of the Mona Lisa." This is the sort of explanation that drives Watts truly bonkers. He bemoans the many analysts, trend spotters, and journalists who claim to understand exactly why some things succeed, but only after their success is obvious to everybody. He would have us beware those who claim they can predict the future, but offer only retrospective proof of their powers. Watts is an expert on information cascades. A cascade is the map of an idea catching on. A global cascade is the map of an idea that's spread far and wide, a massive tree sprouted from a tiny seed. In the real world, global cascades can include both surprise hits, like the tiny stuffed animal Beanie Babies, and all too predictable hits, like a successful Star Wars sequel. Hits and cascades come in all sizes, but they have the same thing in common. Everything starts at zero. To watch how ideas go from zero to a million, Watts designed a model universe with thousands of people, or nodes, as he calls them, connected to other people. Let's call it Watts World. In Watts World, each person or node has two variables. Vulnerability, how likely each person is to adopt a new behavior, and density, how many people are connected to each other. Watts triggered these networks of varying vulnerability and density over and over, millions of times, to watch trends spread to millions of people or, more often, not spread at all. The first thing he realized was that there are Goldilocks zones of vulnerability and density. It's worthless to advertise to an older person who literally never changes her habits, low vulnerability, or to a Siberian hermit, low density. But the opposite poles are also problematic. Let's say you're equally susceptible to an ad from Bloomingdale's, The Gap, and every other clothing outlet you see. This makes you a terrible bet for any one brand because you're constantly changing your mind. A consumer who is hyper-vulnerable to every influence is no more reliable than a consumer who is impervious to all influence. Watts discovered a peculiar point in his network where cascades were incredibly rare but extremely large. 999 times out of 1,000 in this particular Watts world, nothing would happen. But in that 1 in 1,000 moment, the entire network would light up, a massive global cascade. "Huh, that's very interesting," I said. "It's math," he responded. "If a trigger has a 0.1% chance of becoming a global cascade, it will create at least a few global cascades if given thousands of chances. That's just how math works. But imagine what it would be like to live in that 0.1% world. Imagine being a journalist like me, paid to pretend that I understand why everything in that 0.1% world happens. I might see a massive, out-of-nowhere success, like the indie film My Big Fat Greek Wedding, or the Korean pop song Gangnam Style, and be tempted to explain the improbable event as if it were inevitable. When journalists see products succeed, they always want to explain the inevitability of the success, Watts said. They ask, what were the characteristics of the successful thing? And then they decide that all these characteristics must be very special. Or they try to find patient zero, the person who started the trend, because they decide he must be very special. This sort of thinking creates a worthless gospel of success, Watts says. If a dinosaur movie succeeds in May, 1,000 articles are written to claim there is something special about the allure of dinosaurs, even if a dinosaur movie just failed in January. If a Belize musician hits it big in 2016, some writers will decide there must be something intrinsically appealing about Belizean music, even if it's the only Belizean hit of the century. But thinking in probabilities is awfully abstract and often impossible. Forecasters can say there is a 50% chance of rain tonight, or that a movie has a 10% chance of making $100 million in its first weekend. And there can be a significant amount of intelligence built into these calculations. But ultimately, it either rains or it does not. The movie makes $100 million or it doesn't. Probabilities are intuitive for events that happen many times over. You can flip a coin until your fingers are numb and the share of heads and tails will eventually approach 50-50. But life is one giant roulette wheel that only spins around once for each person. So most people don't think in percentages. They process the world in stories, actions and reactions, causes and outcomes. Post hoc ergo propter hoc. Any story is better than chaos. In fact, one might say that the chaos of life is a chronic condition for which stories are the remedy. In Watts' world, the same product can become a smash hit or a dud in nearly equivalent circumstances. It's just a matter of math, timing, and luck. For example, sometimes a rock song comes out on the radio in 1954, and tens of thousands of Americans hear it and don't buy the record. Just like Rock Around the Clock. Then, in 1955, the song comes out again for a slightly different audience in a new medium. The context shifts, a chain reaction of improbable events occurs, and the song that a nation once ignored becomes the national anthem of rock and roll. Just like Rock Around the Clock. One of the 75,000 people who bought the Rock Around the Clock record was a young boy in Beverly Hills named Peter Ford. He came from a family of wide musical talents and kaleidoscopic tastes. His mother, Eleanor Powell, was a celebrated tap dancer who listened to the King of Swing, Benny Goodman, and jazz. His father, Glenn Ford, was a movie star with a penchant for Hawaiian tunes. But young Peter, seeking his own niche, immersed himself in black bands and race music. Peter didn't have many friends visiting him at their 5-acre property, but music was his refuge. Late at night, he huddled alone listening to Hunter Hancock, the first DJ to play rhythm and blues on Los Angeles stations KFVD and KFOX. His mother would indulge him with frequent drives to the Beverly Hills music shop, where he would scoop up armfuls of vinyl, most of them by black men, the true originators of R&B and rock and roll, the kings of rhythm, Johnny Ace, the Orioles, the Crows, the Flamingos, the Larks. If it had a bird in the name, it was for me, Ford told me. The Ford family lived in a 20-room house in Beverly Hills that had previously belonged to Max Steiner, the Hollywood composer who'd scored Casablanca and Gone with the Wind. The home's jewel was the China Room, a 400-square-foot music room decked out with the latest high-fidelity technology by Steiner. The walls gleamed with gold leaf, and wide Chinese murals ran the length of a wall with rivers snaking between skinny green hills. 3-foot-tall speakers anchored 2 corners of the room, and Peter Ford would sit on a green chintz couch and listen to the bird bands. In 1954, on one of countless trips to the Beverly Hills Music Store, a 9-year-old Peter Ford bought a Decca-released 78 record with the A-side song, 13 Women and Only One Man in Town. He hated it. I thought it was terrible, Ford told me, laughing. I mean, I really, really hated it. But then I turned the record over and found Rock Around the Clock. I thought it was a good song with a great drum beat, but I can't say that it was one of my favorites. I was more into the Orioles. A few months later, his father, Glenn Ford, was filming a new movie about inner-city students called Blackboard Jungle. One afternoon, near the end of filming, the movie's director, Richard Brooks, visited the house. Glenn made him a drink, and they talked about the movie's scoring. Brooks told him he was looking for an upbeat song to kick off the movie, a jump-jive tune that would instinctively evoke a generation on edge. Glenn told Brooks that his son had gotten into some edgy music and might have some records to share. I took Dick Brooks and my parents into the music room, and Dick said, "What do you got?" Ford recounted. I gave him a handful of records, something by Joe Houston, Jake Turner's Shake, Rattle, and Roll, and Bill Haley and his Comets' Rock Around the Clock. What happened next burns vividly in Ford's memory and in the national consciousness. It is, in many ways, the birthday of rock and roll as a mainstream American movement. 3 days before my 10th birthday, Blackboard Jungle played a sneak preview on February 2nd at the Encino Theater, he said. I was there with my dad. The movie started with a written preface over the sound of a drum. We in the United States are fortunate to have a school system that is a tribute to our communities and to our faith in American youth. Today we are concerned with juvenile delinquency, its causes, and its effects. We are especially concerned when this delinquency boils over into our schools. The scenes and incidents depicted here are fictional. However, we believe that public awareness is a first step toward a remedy for any problem. It is in this spirit and with this faith that Blackboard Jungle was produced. At this very moment, Bill Haley's famous count began. Ba-dum, 1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. On the downbeat, the words Blackboard Jungle flashed on the screen. The young boy was electrified. His record had made its way to the opening sequence of a major Hollywood film. The breakout success of Rock Around the Clock had everything to do with its placement at the beginning of the film Blackboard Jungle, said Jim Dawson, author of Rock Around the Clock, the record that started the rock revolution. The reaction to Blackboard Jungle was something like hysteria, not just among teenagers, but also among their parents and politicians. Kids danced in the aisles of movie theaters and blasted the song from their cars. On May 17, 1955, the Philadelphia Inquirer reported that Princeton University dorms held a competition to play the song as loudly as possible from their rooms. Around midnight, the students emptied into the quads, set fires to trash cans, and chanted up and down the streets. Meanwhile, several major American cities censored the film. The mayor of Memphis forbade teenagers to see it, while Atlanta tried to ban the movie after an alderman's wife said it threatened the peace, health, morals, and good order of this city. Just as Lefèvre Caillebotte consecrated Impressionism through scandal in the 1890s, Blackboard Jungle's notoriety promoted its opening track, unleashing the rock and roll genre. On July 2nd, 1955, 3 months after Blackboard Jungle debuted, Rock Around the Clock became the top-selling single in the country and the first song called Rock and Roll to reach number one on the Billboard charts, ultimately selling more physical copies than any song by Elvis Presley, The Beatles, Madonna, or Michael Jackson. One of the laws of chaos is that a microscopic change in the present trajectory can lead to wildly different future outcomes. The Brazilian butterfly shakes her wings and a Pacific typhoon forms off the coast of Indonesia. The most popular melodies of 1954 and 1955 were dulcet waltzes compared to the high-tempo hits of the later 1950s. Billboard's number one songs before and after Rock Around the Clock were the schmaltzy Unchained Melody and the minstrel ballad Yellow Rose of Texas, which sounds like it could have been written in the 1850s. Haley's brief usurpation of the charts foretold a later overthrow of the system. By the end of the decade, rock and roll had conquered pop music, bringing with it several cultural and political shifts. First, the center of gravity in pop music shifted from the songs to the stars themselves. The pop icons of the first half of the 20th century, like Frank Sinatra or Bing Crosby, were famous for musical renditions of common songs that families could play at home with sheet music. They were expert interpreters. But the pop stars of the 1960s were bands and artists like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones who wrote, played, and were synonymous with almost all of their own music. The rock revolution meant nothing less than the dawn of the age of the modern pop star. Second, the rise of rock shook American culture in a decade otherwise known for its languid complacency. It's well known that white bands mainstreamed a genre created by black musicians, but the creative exploitation of black artists was even more explicit than that. The most popular songs of the 1950s were often white covers of melodies originally performed by black artists, like Sincerely by the McGuire Sisters, originally by the Moonglows, and Kokomo by Perry Como, originally by Gene and Eunice. In 1955, Billboard finally declared the emergence of the Negro as a pop artist in the disc field. But like Billboard's 1991 consecration of hip-hop, this was a rather tardy acknowledgement of something that had been true for a decade or more. As the rock and roll pantheon became crowded with Elvis Presley, Chuck Berry, and Buddy Holly, critics still refer to it as jungle music. The magazine True Strange featured Haley on a 1957 cover with an illustration of several naked African tribesmen dancing and beating drums. This was not just adults poo-pooing loud music and performative hip gyrations. The music itself was an omen that white America was losing its cultural monopoly, and even suburban families would be forced to confront elements of a black culture that many did not want to acknowledge. It is hard to imagine a world where Blackboard Jungle was never made and rock and roll never had its moment of mass consecration. What does pop music sound like in 1965 or 2015, for that matter? When some products hit, they don't just leave a mark. They sunder the landscape, change the atmosphere, usher in the extinction of an old order. Rock Around the Clock was a cultural asteroid. It didn't just make contact with the Earth. It killed the dinosaurs. Rock Around the Clock is a story of great songwriting, the broadcast power of film, and the crucible of 1950s teenage culture. But it is also a story of Mind-boggling luck. Every person who listens to Rock Around the Clock hears the same notes, words, and syncopation. Audiences in 1954 heard a forgettable song. Audiences in 1955 heard the hit of the century. One song, two slightly different broadcasts, two extremely different outcomes. Sounds like a tune that a chaos theorist might sing. In 1996, the economists Arthur Devaney and David Walls studied the box office returns of about 300 movies released in the 1980s to uncover patterns in audience behavior. What they found, however, was something more like the absence of a pattern. Movies are complex products, they wrote in a follow-up paper, and the cascade of information among filmgoers during the course of a film's run can evolve along so many paths that it is impossible to attribute the success of a movie to individual causal factors. In short, Hollywood is chaos. Success in Hollywood does not follow a normal distribution, with many films earning the box office average. Instead, movies follow a power law distribution, which means most of the winnings come from a tiny minority of films. The best way to imagine a power law market is to think of a lottery. The vast majority of people win nothing, and a few people win millions of dollars. So it makes little sense to talk about the average lottery outcome. It's the same in Hollywood. Hollywood's six major studios released just over 100 movies in 2015. The five most successful films accounted for 22% of the total box office. What is the best way to understand a market both filled with flops and driven by hits? Al Greco, a professor of marketing at Fordham University and an expert in book publishing, summarizes the entertainment business this way. A complex, adaptive, semi-chaotic industry with Bose-Einstein distribution dynamics and Pareto power law characteristics with dual-sided uncertainty. That is quite the disfluent multisyllabic mouthful. But it's worth breaking down, word by word. Complex. Every year, there are hundreds of movies released to billions of potential viewers, who are watching ads, reading critics, and mimicking each other to decide what movie ticket they will buy next. In the short run, the best indication of next week's movie sales is this week's movie sales. But since everybody is constantly influencing everybody else, predicting the distant future box office of a movie is like predicting the final resting place of 16 billiard balls crisscrossing a table and smacking into each other. Adaptive. When a book in one genre succeeds, for example, porny romance, dystopian young adult fiction, or nonfiction pop psychology books, the rest of the industry will adapt to copy it. But aggressive mimicking will eventually chase away the trend, rendering it obsolete by the time some adaptive products hit the market. Paying through the nose for A-list stars seemed like the best bet in 1980s and 1990s Hollywood, and superstar salaries entered a period of hyperinflation until a few flops, like 1993's Last Action Hero starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, shattered the Hollywood religion that superstars could carry any film. On television, viewers recently witnessed this sort of clustering effect in the dark and disturbed male antihero genre. At the moment, comic book heroes seem rather immortal, but there is no way that comics are the final evolution of film. In this way, all hits can ironically sow the seeds of their own demise, as over-imitation ultimately renders the trend obsolete. Semi-chaotic industry with Bose-Einstein distribution dynamics. 100 years ago, scientists Satyendra Nath Bose and Albert Einstein concluded that gas molecules in sealed containers would aggressively cluster at a time and place that was impossible to predict with certainty. Consider it a metaphor for pop culture, with consumers playing the role of gas molecules. At some point in time, they will cluster around an unforeseeable cultural product by buying the same book or attending the same movie. Recall Duncan Watts' big idea. Like a massive earthquake, some global cascades are mathematically inevitable, but they are also impossible to predict too far ahead of time. Pareto's power law characteristics. Vilfredo Pareto, an Italian economist, is credited with discovering that income within a country follows a power law such that 80% of wealth is held by 20% of the population. This Pareto principle has been extended to mean that 80% of sales often comes from 20% of products. In the movie sample Devaney studied, one-fifth of the movies took four-fifths of the box office. In book publishing, more than 90% of revenues come from about 10% of books. In digital markets, it's even worse. 60% of all App Store revenue comes from just 0.005% of companies. For hitmakers, the vast majority of bets are failures. The difference between a great year and a terrible year in publishing might come down to a tiny minority of deals. Dual-sided uncertainty. Screenwriters and producers don't know what viewers want to watch in 2 years. Viewers don't know what movies are coming out in 2 years, nor do they have perfect information about what they want to see. And yet Hollywood is in the business of predicting what audiences want many years in the future, even though most people couldn't even say for sure, even if you asked them. If this makes the business of hits seem hopeless, then good. Making complex products for people who don't know what they want and who aggressively cluster around bizarrely popular products if a couple of their friends do the same is unbelievably difficult work. It's important to appreciate the stress inherent to being a creator, an entrepreneur, a music label, a movie studio, a media company. People are mysterious, and markets are chaos. Is it any surprise that most creativity is failure? One solution for taming the chaos is to own the channels of distribution. Making music is less risky when you can bribe radio stations to play your songs. So the music labels tried exactly that for decades, until the federal government deemed the practice unlawful with the FCC payola rules. Making movies is less risky when you own the theaters that play the films. So the film studios, in fact, owned many of the cinemas for decades, until the Supreme Court decided in 1948 that this constituted an anti-competitive oligopoly, bringing an end to the Hollywood studio system. The problem with owning too much distribution isn't that it doesn't work. Rather, it works so well that it's illegal. The next best solution is to surround audiences with advertising to ensure that every consumer who might be interested in a new product is aware of it. Americans bought almost 30 movie tickets a year in the 1940s. These days, they buy about 4. How could studios wrangle this newly fickle crowd into movie theaters? It would have to turn movies into national blockbuster events. Lavish productions buoyed by monstrous marketing budgets with nonstop commercial and posters plastered on every square inch of the country. In a 1997 economic paper, Devaney said movie studios could reduce the risk of failure through unprecedented promotional expenses. And that's exactly what they did. The number of major studio films has fallen in the last 2 decades, while marketing costs have soared. In 1980, the major studios spent less than 20 cents on advertising for every $1 they earned at the box office. Now, they spend 60 cents to get that buck. Finally, Hollywood has taken a lesson from the second chapter of this book and created original products rooted in familiarity, sequels, adaptations, and reboots of well-known properties. In the last 20 years, Hollywood's core strategy has shifted toward multi-sequel franchises, particularly with superheroes at the center. In 1996, none of the 10 biggest films were sequels or superhero movies, like Independence Day, Twister, and The First Wives Club. And films based on comics accounted for just 0.69% of the box office. In each year so far this decade, most of the 10 top-grossing films were sequels, prequels, or reboots. Of the first 371 movies released in 2016, just 4 superhero films, Captain America Civil War, Deadpool, Batman vs. Superman, and X-Men Apocalypse, accounted for 29% of the total box office. In a way, Hollywood has taken a lesson from old-fashioned serials or modern television. If you find a story that clicks, keep churning out new episodes. The franchise strategy, which prizes familiarity and pre-awareness of characters and stories, is a commercial solution to the chaotic nature of art. But it's also a direct response to the globalization of movies. Americans are on pace to buy fewer tickets per person this decade than at any time since the invention of film. Meanwhile, almost the entire growth in global box office is happening in Eastern Asia and Latin America. The rise of a global crowd encourages studios to produce visual Rosetta Stones, single stories interpretable for many tongues. There is no language in the world more universal than heroes destroying bad guys with the help of explosions. The franchise strategy might be a prudent way to mitigate the uncertainty of the movie-making process, but it carries specific negative consequences, both creative and financial. Writers who observe Hollywood's abandoning of smart, complex dramas for superhero franchises have moved on to television. It's not a coincidence that the golden age of TV coincided with the franchise age of movies. The number of scripted dramas on television, including streaming sites like Netflix and Hulu, increased from about 100 in the late 1990s to more than 400 in 2015. By teaching audiences to see only the movies with the biggest marketing campaigns, studios risk impoverishing smaller films and pushing their future auteurs into the welcoming arms of TV executives. What's more, the blockbuster strategy guarantees that the flops will be spectacular and, for film executives, devastating. All but 3 of the 30 biggest box office bombs in Hollywood history were released since 2005. As they say in baseball, live by the long ball, die by the long ball. Sooner or later, chaos wins. Blackboard Jungle was a notorious film with an impressive box office, but it wasn't quite a blockbuster. The movie's 1955 box office gross made it the 13th most popular film of the year, behind Cinerama Holiday, Mr. Roberts, Battle Cry, Oklahoma, Guys and Dolls, Lady and the Tramp, Strategic Air Command, Not as a Stranger, To Hell and Back, The Sea Chase, The 7-Year Itch, and The Tall Men. If you've heard of 5 of those 13 movies, you have me beat. And yet they were all more popular than the film that launched the best-selling rock song of all time. There is no statistical model in the world to forecast that the forgotten B-side of a middling record played over the credits of the 13th most popular movie of any year will automatically become the most popular rock and roll song of all time. The business of creativity is a game of chance, A complex, adaptive, semi-chaotic game with Bose-Einstein distribution dynamics and Pareto's power law characteristics with dual-sided uncertainty. You